Becoming a member at Navy Federal Credit Union could help you to earn more and save more. Their certificate options could earn you more than standard savings accounts with competitive rates.
Not all financial institutions offer you as many choices for savings options as Navy Federal does. For example, you can start your savings journey with a low minimum deposit, add money at any time, and watch your savings grow. Thanks to flexible terms, you can use Navy Federal savings options for all kinds of goals, short or long term. Navy Federal also offers equity loan options to help you get the funds you need to consolidate high interest debt, work on home improvements, or cover any of life's big expenses.
To learn more, visit NavyFederal.org. At Navy Federal, their members are the mission. Navy Federal is insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Lender, membership required. Terms and conditions apply, loan subject to approval. In recent weeks, we've really focused on some ways that listeners can boost their income. So whether that's through starting your own side business and growing your network like Hala talked about, or when we talked with local realtor Alan about diving into investing in real estate, well, what better way to test the waters? While you are away, your home could also earn extra income.
That's right. Your empty space could be an Airbnb while you're traveling, because that's all you need to become an Airbnb host. It's a lot easier than you think, and you don't need to Airbnb your entire house. You could just host your extra spare room. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casual and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Welcome to How to Money. I'm Joel.
And I am Matt.
And today we're talking FAFSA hacks to curb college costs with the FAFSA guru.
Right, we are excited to be discussing the free application for federal student aid today, also known as the FAFSA, because other than the cost of a hospital visit, nothing has skyrocketed in price like college tuition and fees over the past 20 years. So you think your house or your new car is crazy expensive? Nope. You just wait until your kids start looking at colleges. And that's why we're excited to be joined by Tina Steele, who is known as the FAFSA guru. Tina is an expert when it comes to financial aid. She has decades of experience, and that's whether she was working directly for public and private universities, whether she was leading a statewide initiative in Maine helping disadvantaged students to pursue college, or just creating incredibly valuable videos for her YouTube channel. We're going to be discussing all things FAFSA today. So Tina, thank you for coming on the How to Money podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, guys. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, no, we're excited to chat with you as well, Tina. Lots to cover on the show, but the first question we have to ask you, that we ask anybody who comes on the show, is what your craft beer equivalent is, and that's because Matt and I, we like to drink fancy craft beers while also saving and investing wisely for the future. What's that for you? What's your kind of splurge while you're also handling your money properly?
Oh gosh, I'm a Christmas fanatic. I am over the top with Christmas, everything Christmas, decorations, ooh, gifts for the delivery drivers. We have a big family gathering on Christmas Eve of 20 to 25 people, and we get matching t-shirts. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, matching t-shirts.
I love it.
Wait, you do matching t-shirts every year, or
we
is it like...
do. Yeah, I usually do something different every year. Last year was matching t-shirts. This year I'm trying to figure out what it's going to be, but there's usually some kind of theme and everybody gets a gift.
That
I love
is
Christmas.
Awesome.
So you do Christmas the way a lot of people do Disney, basically.
Yes, absolutely. That is a great way to compare it, for sure.
That's awesome. It's always fun to kind of hear what it is that folks like to splurge on. And honestly, though, I'm not going to say that your splurge in this case is wacky, because we put out some Christmas decorations, but
it's unique, which I love.
Yeah, exactly. But Tina, can you give us, I guess, just a general overview as to why it is the FAFSA is so important? Let's kind of just ease folks into the whole conversation and just talk about the merits of the FAFSA.
Sure. Yeah. So the FAFSA is important first and foremost so that students can access federal and state financial aid and some institutional aid, depending on the college, in order to help them pay for their education. So a lot of people, you know, when they think about FAFSA, they might not even realize the importance of it, or they don't understand financial aid, or maybe on the other side of that, they think they might not qualify for enough financial aid. So I tell everybody, every single person that plans on going to college should fill out a FAFSA, unless, of course, they have like several hundred thousand dollars sitting in an account earmarked specifically for college.
Okay. All right. So we're going to ask a ton of follow-up questions, some of which will probably sound a little dumb because and you're the FAFSA guru, so for you these are going to be like knock them out of the ballpark sort of questions, but for most people, because it's one of those infrequent things, right? It's not like you're sending a kid off to college every year for 30 years or something like that, like, and you get used to it and you figure it out, it feels brand new, I think, for most people every single time. It's like for the infrequent traveler, the trying to get to the airport, how do I time it and when do I get there and how does security work again? That's how a lot of people feel if you only travel every 5 years. So do you have to know which colleges you're applying to before you fill out the FAFSA?
No. So you need to have at least one college listed on the FAFSA when you fill it out and submit it. And you're filling out the FAFSA probably simultaneously as you're applying for admission for college or even before. So you do not have to know. You can log back in at any time and add colleges to the FAFSA once it's submitted. But just for that first initial submission, you need to have at least one listed.
Nice. And it doesn't really matter which one you select.
I'm assuming
most people choose whatever popular state school that they know there's maybe a high chance of their kid getting into.
Harvard, right. Matt, personally.
Or can you do that? Or can you choose like the most elite? It truly doesn't matter.
And you can do up to 20?
You can this year, starting with the 24-25 year, it's going to be 20. It's always been 10. So, you can go up to 20, but some students apply for even more. So you just submit it to the 20 colleges and then log back in once it's processed, delete some colleges, and add some more if you have more than 20.
Nice. Makes sense. It's kind of like if you're going to go out to eat. It's like, well, I don't know exactly where we're going to go. But step one, we got to get in the car and just start heading out of the neighborhood.
Yes. For sure.
Okay, well, so talk to us then about some of the recent FAFSA changes. Let's talk about the FAFSA Simplification Act.
Yeah.
And like one of the changes they made had to do with the actual form that you fill out. In the past, it was kind of lengthy. It was kind of tedious. Talk about some of the changes they made there.
Sure. It's always been very tedious. So one of the big reasons for FAFSA simplification is to make it easier to fill out. Currently, there's 108 questions on the FAFSA. With this new simplification process, it's going down to just 38 questions, which is really going to be significant and a time saver. There's a lot of things, a lot of changes happening. You know, they're expanding Pell Grant eligibility. Pell Grant is the free grant the government offers for families under a certain amount of money. Typically, that's been, you know, families or students who make less than $50,000 a year. That's being expanded to $60,000 a year for 24-25. There's also another really big change happening. You know, if you're familiar with the FAFSA or financial aid, you've heard of the expected family contribution, or EFC. This is the number that the government comes up with when they perform their federal methodology and process the FAFSA. This is technically the amount of money that a student is expected to contribute towards their education for the year. They are changing the EFC to what's going to be called the Student Aid Index, or the SAI. And the reason for this is because there's been a lot of confusion. When families get this EFC, they think that that's the exact amount of money that they have to pay for the year, and that is not necessarily the case. In a lot of cases, it could be more, and in some cases, it could be less. So they're really trying to alleviate some confusion around that. And then one really big change happening that's not the best change is for families who have multiple children in college, they're no longer going to get the same financial benefit that they always have.
Yeah, that seemed like a big downer.
That's a bummer for
Joel's got triplets.
Joel's got three kids. Yeah. I've got four kids. And there's a good chance there's going to be a decent amount of overlap as those kids are going to be in college. Can you explain, I guess, how it used to work and then now, given the changes, what that means for
us? Sure. So I'm going to talk about the EFC because that's what it's been all along. So normally when you have more than one child in college, that EFC gets divided equally among the number of children in college. So, and, you know, if you have a $20,000 EFC, but two kids in college, each student would have a $10,000 EFC. So the lower that number, the more financial aid that the student's going to get. So that's where that's not going to happen. The student, if you have two or three students in college and your EFC is $20,000, it's going to be $20,000 for each student.
For each kid, yeah, rather than the entire household.
Yeah. So it is a bummer. It's one of the changes that I'm not thrilled about. However, it's going to be very, very important that families who have more than one child in college actually appeal their financial aid offers.
Hmm. Yeah, so I was going to say, that EFC, or now the Student Aid Index, when that number gets spit out, that doesn't necessarily, that's not your bill. That's not what you pay, right? Like, that's
nope.
Tell us how that number relates to what you end up paying, though.
Sure. So when you get that number, what the college does is they take their total cost of attendance. So their cost of attendance would be tuition, fees, room and board, books and supplies, the all-in cost. So let's say the college is $60,000 a year. It's a private college. They're going to take your EFC and let's say, for example, it's $30,000 just for a number. They subtract the EFC from the cost of attendance to come up with a student's financial need. So in this scenario, the student's financial need would be $30,000. Then they try to package the student with as much need-based aid as possible to meet that financial need. So it's a really big part of the equation. You know, the higher that number, the lower need-based financial aid the student qualifies for, or the less.
Yep.
Yeah.
Again, a massive bummer for us
who
have multiple kids. And I mean, you've got a bunch of kids too.
I'm sure.
I'm sure you were very excited to hear that news.
We were joking before we started that, Tina, that you started your service basically as a personal endeavor to save as much money on college.
Yeah.
Six kids total, like, that'll do it, right?
Yeah, six kids. And, you know, our youngest one is a high school senior right now, so she's the last of them. I mean, I have had the benefit of having multiple children in college and kind of also, you know, being on the other side of this, knowing, you know, what to do and how to really maximize financial aid, but it's still expensive. College is astronomically expensive.
Did I see that there's a change when it came to a child who, or a, you know, a scholar, a future student who's applying to a school that comes from a divorced home? How does that work out as far as who has to fill out the FAFSA?
Yep, that's another big change. So currently, when you fill out the FAFSA and you have a divorced or separated parent situation, as long as the parents are living in separate household, only one parent needs to fill out the FAFSA on behalf of the student. And all along, that's been the parent with whom the child resided with most within the last year. Going forward with the 24-25 year, it's going to be the parent who provides more than half of that child's support, whether or not that is the custodial parent. So that's a really big change happening to the FAFSA. However, it is going to be a very gray area because, you know, it's going to be hard to really prove what, you know, which parent actually provides more than half support, but that's the guideline.
So it seems like it's more about money. It's more about income and financial support as opposed to how many nights that they're spending at that particular house.
Yes, exactly.
Gotcha. All right, talk to us about the timing delay. So not only are we getting an updated FAFSA this year, right? We're getting the fewer questions, hopefully the easier to fill out FAFSA, but why are we talking December, right? Why are we talking months delayed?
Yeah.
What's going on there? Is it literally just the process of creating and it takes time to release the updated version?
It is, because there's so many changes being made. They did intend to have this all completed by October 1st, but it's just been delayed just because of all the hoops they're jumping through and the changes that are being made. They just could not get it finalized in time. So there's a lot happening. The FAFSA is getting a major overhaul, probably the biggest overhaul that it's ever received in its history. So that's why.
Okay. So speaking of timing, you say, and we've touched on this before on the show before, but it's important to go ahead and fill the FAFSA out sooner rather than later. Can you explain to listeners why that's the case?
Yeah, so with the FAFSA, it's kind of like the early bird gets the worm. The earlier you get that filled out, the more financial aid you can have access to. There are certain pools and, let's say, pockets of money that colleges have to offer, and like once that money runs out, it runs out. So the earlier you get that FAFSA, FAFSA in, the better. That's really what it comes down to. And there's also state deadlines for the FAFSA in order for students to be considered for state grants. Every state has their own deadline, so it's crucial that you look up and see what your state's deadline is and get it submitted before then.
Gotcha. Is there ever the case where there's more money of it, like where it's the opposite, like something comes along and all of a sudden there's an additional funding or something like that? Is that a...
Not typically.
Okay. No. Early bird gets the worm. Nice.
Yeah. I mean, lower income families who make less than $60,000, they're going to be okay regardless.
No,
like
matter
with
what.
With the Pell Grant money, because that's federal money that's always there. But that state grant money, you know, if they don't fill out the FAFSA before that deadline, they could miss out on it.
Okay. How onerous is it to actually fill out the FAFSA? It's obvious it's going to be easier this year once it gets released shortly.
Yes.
But how bad is it? I think people build it up in their minds, and this is probably why a lot of people avoid it. They're like, that thing? No. I don't want to bludgeon myself in the face, so why would I fill out the FAFSA? Like, how bad, how long is it actually going to take people to do?
So right now with 108 questions, it takes a good hour or more. Going down to 38, I anticipate families are going to be able to get through this in less than 30 minutes.
Nice.
Easily. And there's going to be an automatic transfer of data that's happening from the IRS, kind of pre-populating information. So it's going to be quick and easy.
Yeah. Is that the DRT, the IRS?
Yes. Data retrieval tool.
Yeah.
So it's like pulling in stuff that you would have otherwise had to manually enter in yourself?
Yeah, like go and look at each tax line and put that information in. And that's been on the FAFSA for a few years, but they're streamlining it more this year, so it's going to be like an automatic and even smoother process.
Nice. When I was reading about that, it made me think of like credit card autofill on when I'm in the browser.
Yeah.
It's just like auto-populates, and it just makes it so easy.
Definitely.
Yeah, and just as a reminder for folks as well, This isn't something you just do one time as you are applying to school. I think sometimes if you think, oh, okay, I'm applying to schools. Oh, okay, I'm filling out the FAFSA. It's easy to remember to do that, I guess, maybe that first year. But do you ever run into situations where families forget mm-hmm. in subsequent years to actually fill out the FAFSA?
Yes, and it's so important, you know, to make sure you're filling that out every single year, you know, because you can miss deadlines. You can miss, like, your state grant deadline and miss out on money that you might have otherwise received. So just set a reminder on your phone, whatever you need to do. But yeah, fill it out every single year early.
All right. Talk to us about like the children of the elite, like Jeff Bezos's kids and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, should Jeff Bezos fill out the FAFSA? Because if we're talking about the FAFSA as being mostly about financial aid eligibility, why would someone who's making bank, has a lot of financial assets, why would they still take the time? Even the now reduced time frame that we're talking about, do they still need to actually go through this laborious or not so laborious process?
So that's a great question. There are some scholarships that use the FAFSA in order to determine whether or not students are going to receive the scholarship. They're few and far between, but really, honestly, the big reason for any like high-income families to fill out the FAFSA would be if they want the student to be able to take a direct student loan in their own name, you know, to help, you know, have some skin in the game and help them pay for college. Because in order for a student to borrow a federal direct loan in their own name, a FAFSA has to be filled out along with a federal parent plus loan. So let's say a parent, even though they have the money and the means, they want to borrow a loan to pay for their child's education. In order to take this parent loan, they'd have to fill out a FAFSA form. So those would really be, you know, the only reasons I would recommend a very wealthy family fill out the FAFSA.
More of a psychological mindset kind of game.
Right. But all middle and upper middle income families should definitely fill out a FAFSA because at the very least, if they don't qualify for any need-based financial aid, like in scholarships or grants other than merit, then they can appeal their financial aid offers and ask for more money. You know, 80% of students who appeal their financial aid offers will receive additional aid. And a lot of families aren't aware of that.
Nice. Well, we are going to talk a little bit more about appealing some of those aid packages. We're going to talk more about the numbers and what goes into determining the kind of financial aid that you're going to get. And we'll get to all of that with Tina right after this. You You probably think it's too soon to join AARP, right? Well, let's take a minute to talk about it. Where do you see yourself in 15 years? More specifically, your career, your health, your social life? What are you doing now to help you to get there? Well, there are tons of ways for you to start preparing today for your future with AARP.
What about that dream job you've dreamt about? Sign up for AARP reskilling courses to help make it a reality. How about that active lifestyle you've only spoken about from the couch? AARP has health tips and wellness tools to keep you moving for years to come. But none of these experiences are without making friends along the way. Connect with your community through AARP volunteer events.
So, it's safe to say, it's never too soon to join AARP. They're here to help your money, your health, and happiness live as long as you do. That's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Learn more at aarp.org/wisefriend.
And now, a word from the show's sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry, Betterment is here to help.
Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns, meaning when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal. Rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again.
Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed. Spring cleaning is kind of an annual rite of passage. We've all got to do it, minimize the junk that we have in our house. Emily and I, we just cleaned our closets out. It took hours, but it was so worth it. Now we've only got stuff in there that we love, and it's easier to find everything too. And so, you know, while cleaning your closets is helpful, well, there's something else you can do for your family this spring. Shopping for life insurance with Policy Genius, for example, is a really important part of your financial planning for the year.
That's right. Yeah. And here is the thing that's important to remember, because you might be thinking you don't need to check out Policy Genius because you've got a policy through work. But even if you have a life insurance policy through your job, it may not offer you enough protection for your family's needs, and it may not follow you if you leave your job. With Policy Genius, you can find life insurance policies that start at just $292 per year for $1 million of coverage. Some options offer same-day approval and avoid unnecessary medical exams. Policy Genius works for you, not the insurance companies, and that means they don't have an incentive to recommend one insurer over another, so you can trust their guidance.
Save time and money and provide your family with a financial safety net using Policy Genius. Head to PolicyGenius.com to get your free life insurance quotes and see how much you could save. That's PolicyGenius.com. All right, we're back. We're talking with Tina Steele. We're talking about filling out the FAFSA.
She's the FAFSA guru,
I know,
Joel.
Why do you think we had her on? Matt? Like, who else can we talk to about this? Tina, I guess I'm curious, like, while you're filling out the FAFSA form, is there any way to screw it up or to optimize your chances, maybe, let's say, of receiving financial aid from universities? Is there something that, when you're actually answering the questions, that you can do to either detract or impact your ability to get the kind of aid you're looking for?
Joel wants to know if it's okay to lie.
Right.
Yeah, I know. It's really, you know, honestly, the biggest mistakes I see in this area, there's a couple. One is when families are divorced or separated and they filed a joint tax return for the year prior. They have the tax information sent over with both their and their spouse's income, which could really impact the amount of financial aid they get because they only need one parent's income on the FAFSA. So that's a really, really big one. And just to note on that, if that parent filling out the FAFSA is remarried, then they do take into consideration the step-parent's income and asset
so
information,
that could
which is a bummer, too.
So you might even want to plan your marriage according to when your kids are going off to school.
I know, right. No, it's true. The other thing is, you know, reporting assets incorrectly. That's probably where I see the biggest mistakes made. And that's what it comes down to is mistakes. Because the FAFSA asks for concrete, you know, figures from your tax form. There's really no way around getting around that. There's a lot of information that families self-report. You know, how much money you have in your bank account, how much your investments are worth. I mean, you're self-reporting that information. But there's two assets in particular that don't have to be reported on the FAFSA, which is the the value of the primary home that you live in, along with the value of your retirement accounts.
Nice.
A lot of times families accidentally report that as an investment and they can really miss out on financial aid.
If that is something that someone does, are they able to go back and correct that? And how does that work if you've made a mistake?
Yes. Once you realize you made a mistake, the first thing you'd want to do is log back into the FAFSA and click on Make a Correction. Okay. And just navigate to the section and do that, and then make sure you resubmit it. If it's late in the year and like the student has already received their financial aid offer, then it's going to be important that the family reach out directly to the financial aid office to let them know okay. about the mistake after they make the
correction.
At
the particular college that they're
college.
Looking at. Gotcha.
Yes.
So selfishly, Matt and I, we're... Our main goal is to get How to Money listeners to save and invest more of their money, right? To sock more money away into tax advantage retirement accounts so that they have more, they're building wealth and they have more money in those retirement years. I guess, one of the things that's true as well is that if you save more for retirement, you actually could potentially get a larger financial aid offer. Is that right? And is that truly just because you're reducing your previous year's adjusted gross income?
No, and actually that's a little bit of misinformation that's out there in a way, because what's happened all along is even though you don't have to report the value of your retirement account, you have in the past had to report the contributions. So if you take like a big chunk of money and you put it towards your retirement account, that's actually counted as untaxed income for the family for that year. However, that's changing for the 24-25 year. Okay. So your question is going to be a little more accurate. They're not going to look at those contributions anymore. So yes, sheltering that money in a retirement account or paying down your mortgage on your primary home is going to be the way to
okay.
go. And of course, this is only for colleges that require the FAFSA, because the colleges that also require the CSS profile, which is a supplemental form, there are no assets that are protected.
Okay. Yep. Yeah. So that's an entirely different
yep.
form.
Yep.
Is it a lot of private universities that...
A lot of the private universities, okay. yeah. So that, you know, typically no public or state colleges require that.
So should people proactively be searching out the CSS, filling that out just in case? Or is that something where if you get accepted to one of these schools then and they request it, that's when you fill it out?
So the CSS opens the same, typically October 1st, like the FAFSA. So it's really important to know whether or not the college requires it when you go into the process, because you want to get that done early, like in October. So it's kind of just like the FAFSA. You'd be initiating it yourself. You can do a simple Google search, colleges that require the CSS profile, and pull up an alphabetical list of all those colleges. And then you want to get that filled out along with the FAFSA.
Gotcha. Okay, so to clarify, it sounds like with the new changes, by contributing to a pre-tax retirement account, you are effectively lowering your AGI. And is that the mechanism in which that could then allow you to receive more student aid? Is that how that works?
Yeah, so you are lowering your AGI, which definitely goes into the equation, but they do also look at the income earned from each parent. In addition, so that they're going to look at like the wages, salaries, and tips
okay.
on W-2s or the business income in addition to the AGI. So it can help, because the AGI definitely will be differently, but I don't know that it helps quite as much as we would like it to, but it definitely can.
Gotcha. That's good to know. Okay. What about 529 plans? Because I feel like a lot of parents out there, maybe they're kind of, they've got like a two-year-old and they've heard about the 529. Oh, and in fact, the 529 plan got a little bit better over
flexible.
The past couple of years, because if you don't use it for education, you can kind of roll that into a Roth IRA. And so they do look more attractive, but I think there's a lot of folks who may not have really parsed through the details, I guess, and they're not totally sure how much that plan is going to offset the ability of that student to receive aid. Can you kind of shed some light there for folks?
Yeah, so the value of a 529 plan is counted as a parent investment on the FAFSA, and the government expects that parents can contribute about 5.65% of their total asset value towards their child's education for the year. So 5.65% of whatever assets, you know, they own are going to be factored into that EFC, or what's going to be called the Student Aid Index next year. So the 529 is a great plan, and you know, the nice thing is, as long as it's a parent-owned 529, the distributions are not going to count against the student in any way as untaxed income. So it is a great way for parents to kind of start early investing for their child's education.
Gotcha. And to clarify, that's total assets, not
right.
necessarily just the
total 529
plan.
Total investments and assets that you have to report on the yeah. FAFSA. Right.
So that's going in there, factoring in if you have investment real estate,
yes.
what you have in your taxable brokerage account, that kind of, it's all going into one thing. And it's like, all right, we expect you can pay 5.65% of
yes.
that total.
Yep. There's definitely more emphasis okay. being placed on wealth for the upcoming year versus income. So anything that you have like that is going to impact you for sure.
Okay. All right. Let's talk about income. You mentioned that. It does have a lot to do with how much financial aid is offered, even though wealth is taking a bigger front row seat. But for married couples filing jointly, and you briefly mentioned this number earlier, $60,000 AGI. That seems to be mm-hmm. kind of a line of demarcation, a line in the sand. Mm-hmm. Any advice maybe on how folks should pre-plan if they're close to that mark? Let's say somebody makes their annual salary $68,000 a year, and you know that $60,000 AGI mark triggers additional benefits from a college financial aid perspective. Are there kind of some tweaks they need to make, some ways they need to be thinking about kind of maneuvering their income into that bracket?
Yeah, I mean, what the 60,000 mark is, what that means is like an automatic zero EFC or SAI. So having a zero for that number means the student is going to qualify for like the maximum amount of financial aid. So that's not to say if they make 68,000 or 74,000 that the student is not going to get any need-based aid. What's going to happen is, you know, after 60,000 up until there's not really an actual cutoff because a number of things are taken into consideration, but let's just say around 75 to 80,000, that free grant money the government offers, then the state grant money is going to be prorated based on that income. So that they may still qualify for some, but yeah, the closer to that $60,000 mark, families can keep it, the better. Now, if they make 60,000, but they have $500,000 in assets or investments, it's kind of a moot point because that's really going to drive up that EFC or student aid index. Mm. So yeah, and there's a question when you fill out the FAFSA, if you make less than 60,000 and you fill out a simple like tax return with no schedules, there's a question that asks if you want to skip questions about your assets. However, if you fill out any schedules with your taxes, it doesn't allow you to skip the asset question, which means then you have to go in and report the investment. So that's where it can get some families also.
Interesting. So what Joel really needs to do then when his daughter goes off to school is he needs to, well, first of all, I need to fire him or drop him down to like a $40,000 salary.
Which you were planning on doing anyway.
And then he needs to not claim any deductions and not file any schedules so that he's able to skip.
You know, the big one is real estate. Like when you own real estate other than your home, you have to fill out certain schedules. So, yeah.
It's still there. Yeah, you can't.
Yep.
Yeah. All right.
All right. Let's talk about
Get around it, Joel.
Yeah, I know. Sorry. Yeah. I think there's ways you can play to your advantage, but there's no way to necessarily game the system, right? And
right.
Yeah.
Right.
But that's probably what people want.
But that's where, you know, strategy comes in when, like we mentioned appealing financial aid offers and then scholarships, which I know we'll probably get into.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Let's talk about aid offers because, you know, what if the school we want to go to doesn't make a compelling financial aid offer? You've mm-hmm. mentioned the appeal. Is that the main recourse? And you used you said 80% success rate for financial aid appeals?
Yep. For the students, from what I've seen, 75 to 80% are, you know, successful in getting some additional aid. I've seen it range anywhere from $3,000 all the way up to $30,000.
Wow.
So,
okay.
So there's
That's
a couple of
substantial.
So there's a couple of pieces of information. There's one thing that families can do that can help them get additional aid, and that is they can report what's called special circumstances. So for example, the FAFSA, the 24-25 FAFSA is going to be based on 22 income. Maybe that a parent or a student lost a job in 23, so their 23 income is going to be a lot less. Or maybe their 22 income was inflated due to like a one-time source of income, such as a retirement distribution or a capital gain, or maybe their significant medical or dental expenses. Those are all things that are considered special circumstances that students and families can actually report directly to the college financial aid offices. Mm. they're going to have them fill out a form, and then they can actually recalculate the financial aid offer based on this new information.
Okay.
So that's a big one for any families that fall into that category. And then for families that don't, who just get this offer that, you know, is not enough, they can write a financial aid appeal letter, usually within a couple of weeks of receiving that offer, and humbly ask the financial aid office for additional aid. They can use other financial aid offers they receive from other colleges that are better. And it really just comes down to the college. Some colleges have a very clear policy, and they will not accept financial aid appeals unless a student has special circumstances, whereas other colleges will accept financial aid appeals regardless. So it depends.
Gotcha. Yeah, so it's not like you can... It's really hard to compare apples to apples because of the way that these different colleges... that their estimates work, right? And even when it comes to the FAFSA, like there are different calculators online, but it seems like that those aren't all that accurate compared to maybe the calculator of a specific school. Is that accurate?
Right. Yeah. The net price calculators on the college websites are the way to go. And those aren't always accurate either, but the more in-depth the net calculator is, the more questions that they ask, the more accurate they typically tend to be.
That makes sense.
All right. And you, I think you even have like... classes where you teach people how to write a good appeal letter, and you basically say that the worst they could say is no. So if you maybe you waste 30 minutes, an hour of your time writing a good appeal letter,
right.
But the worst they say is no. So okay, cool. But the best they
it's
can
best
do
best case
it.
Scenario $30,000.
Right. I mean,
you got that back.
Seriously.
Right. So
yeah,
what are the strategies then to maybe write the most effective appeal letter?
So really, you know, there's a term a lot of other professionals, in the field, you'll see them use the term negotiate. I steer clear from that term. You know, when you're appealing to a financial aid director, you want to come across as humble. There are a lot of circumstances in families that aren't necessarily reflected on the FAFSA, such as the cost of living where a family lives, or maybe extra expenses in the household related to a child who has disabilities, or maybe you're helping support elderly parents, or maybe you're just, you know, on your income as a family of four, you don't have enough disposable income left over to pay, you know, this money. So you're really just asking them, you're kind of pulling anything in you can that might apply to you based on, you know, your financial situation, cost of living, where you live, anything that, you know, would not be reflected in the FAFSA. And also, you know, adding a paragraph in there about why this college is the first choice college, how important it is to the student. What is it about this college? What is the student going to bring to the table, you know, on campus? And then you just ask.
Nice.
And like I said, you know, the worst they're going to say is no.
So make that subjective appeal, why it is that you want to go there. But then it almost sounds like you're not necessarily saying to like grovel, but maybe kiss the
right
ring. Like,
yes, okay. Yes. It makes a difference. I used to work in the financial aid offices reviewing the appeal letters, so it really can make a difference.
All right, nice. I like your speak. Again, this is why we're talking with you, Tina. You've got just so much experience with lots of different institutions. Okay, I'm curious to hear your thoughts. Like, do you recommend for folks to go ahead and just choose the college that they go to based on the package they receive, or... do you take a good offer and then basically you're armed with that information, and then if there's another school that you really want to go to, is it about presenting that information in a compelling way and seeing if you can get them to juice their packages? Yeah, what would you say there?
Yeah, the best thing to do is, you know, get all the financial aid offers back. They're all going to, provided you're applying like, you know, regular decision, all of them regular decision, or all of them early action, you're going to be getting these offers back all around the same time. So compare and contrast. There's always a top choice that students have, and it never fails that the top choice is always the most expensive financially, and they get the least amount of financial aid. So yes, you know, use the other offers and what your bottom line might be at those other colleges in terms of affordability in that humble financial aid appeal letter that you write, with the hopes they're going to come back and at least, you know, make it so it's more affordable. It really comes down to families and what their bottom line is, what they can afford, and what they're willing, you know, to take on for debt, because that's another thing that I hate to see students get riddled with.
Yeah.
Significant debt.
For sure. Obviously, that's become a massive problem in our society. And And so I guess you're saying use some of those data points. Don't be afraid to say, hey, actually, in that appeal letter, maybe, well, this other school, great school, they've offered me this, but this is my number one choice. And if you could if you could somehow get close to that, that would really make it possible for me to go here.
Yep, that's exactly what we did. My stepson did. And that's, you know, how he got a much better offer at the college he really wanted to go to. So it works. And I help families with it all the time.
That's great. I love it. All right, Tina, we got a few more questions to get to with you, including what about grad students? How does the FAFSA and, you know, getting additional financial help for grad school, how can we go about doing that? We'll get to that and more right after this.
You probably think it's too soon to join AARP, right? Well, let's take a minute to talk about it. Where do you see yourself in 15 years? More specifically, your career, your health, your social life? What are you doing now to help you to get there? Well, there are tons of ways for you to start preparing today for your future with AARP.
What about that dream job you've dreamt about? Sign up for AARP reskilling courses to help make it a reality. How about that active lifestyle you've only spoken about from the couch? AARP has health tips and wellness tools to keep you moving for years to come. But none of these experiences are without making friends along the way. Connect with your community through AARP volunteer events.
So, it's safe to say, it's never too soon to join AARP. They're here to help your money, your health, and happiness live as long as you do. That's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Learn more at aarp.org/wisefriend.
I'm guessing that a lot of listeners are starting to solidify their summer travel plans. We always like to get the families together, Matt, for a week at the beach every single summer. We've already got that trip to St. Simon's on the calendar. Pumped for that. But sometimes those vacations get expensive. So what better way to offset some of those costs than to have your home earning some money while you're away?
That's right. Why let it sit empty when it could be earning extra income? It's the financially smart thing to do. So think it through. Maybe you've got some extra space in your home, or maybe you have an entire house to host. Or maybe you're just going on vacation and your home is sitting empty. In every case, you can Airbnb it. You already have the space, so it won't be a huge adjustment.
I mean, the way I see it, if you're not using your space, you have two options. You can let it just sit there empty, or you do some optimizing and make some money off it. Really, if you think about it, you already have an Airbnb. You just need to start using it. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
If you're listening to this podcast right now and you're a small business owner, listen up. Upswell Marketing would like to remind you that when customers choose your small business, they're actually choosing you. So focus on super serving your existing customers and let Upswell handle the pipeline generation of new leads and customers. They do everything from hyper-targeting best fit prospects through campaign optimization. Upswell Marketing's unique approach includes direct mail, search engine marketing, and social media ads, and has fueled more than 10,000 small business success stories. Upswell specializes in developing customized direct response campaigns and is now offering a no-obligation free assessment of your current marketing strategies. Not to mention, new customers also receive 15% off their first order when they mention that they heard about Upswell on this podcast. For more information, visit upswellmarketing.com. That's upswellmarketing.com.
We are back from the break talking with the FAFSA guru. We're talking with Tina. And Tina, so I don't have any kids in college, so I'm definitely not even thinking about grad school or like getting even higher levels.
I am, because my wife's in grad school right now.
That's right. Yeah, you are.
Oh, so nice.
Is there a special FAFSA for grads? if you're going to get your master's, sure. How does that work? What are some of the different changes that we've seen regarding that?
It's the same FAFSA for graduate students. They'd just be filling it out as an independent student and not needing their parent information. And the big thing with graduate students is financial aid becomes more limited. Graduate students typically are eligible to borrow up to $20,500 a year in a federal direct student loan that's not based on credit. It's a guaranteed. The government offers it to them to help them pay for their education. And they can also borrow graduate plus loans to help make up any additional costs like above and beyond that $20,000 a year mark. But in terms of the free money, that's more limited. Graduate students can apply for like graduate assistantships through different academic departments at the college where they can do some work and actually receive money towards their tuition or off their tuition or in the form of a paycheck. And then, of course, there are a lot of scholarships out there that graduate students can apply for. But the FAFSA is really for that federal direct loan for graduate students of that amount.
Okay. So if you need to take out loans, we have been paying cash so far. Hope to continue to do that for my wife's graduate school education. But yeah, scholarships, it's honestly something I hadn't thought. Like, I remember applying for scholarships when I was going off to get my undergrad, but I hadn't really thought about it for some reason. It hadn't dawned on me until I was like thinking about our conversation with you. And I was like, wait a second. We could totally look up some scholarships for my wife's particular major, the direction she's heading in, and send out some applications, which we haven't done yet. But now I'm going to get going. Talk to me about scholarships, because I guess on the other side of the equation, they can sound nice, but it feels like you put in a lot of effort for this one-off attempt, mm-hmm. and maybe there's one scholarship available or five $1,000 scholarships available, and you don't really know how much competition you've got and stuff like that. Should we be filling out applications for scholarships? And if so, is there kind of a best way to go about it?
I think it's worth it. This is where I see a lot of students leave money on the table. It is true, searching and applying for scholarships can be a bit tedious, especially because a lot of the applications require essays and things like that. But the students who are doing it consistently throughout the year, like maybe they're applying for a few each and every month, are the ones that are going to get the most bang for their buck. And scholarships that are like $3,000 and less tend to be not as competitive as other scholarships. So those are always good ones to focus on. You know, when you're focusing on those big $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 scholarships, so are a lot of other
sure.
students. So there's going to be a ton of competition. But really with scholarships, it's so important to just be consistent. You know, do a lot of specific Google searching with like terms, you know, multiple terms, not just, you know, like scholarships for high school students pursuing engineering, or, you know, scholarships for graduate students pursuing education, and then maybe even add to that who live in, you know, Portland, Maine. So the more search terms you can put, the more you'll kind of narrow down some good scholarship opportunities, like locally, which is always good. I always recommend checking with your state higher education agency. Every state has one of these agencies, and a lot of students aren't aware of this, and they house scholarship information specifically for residents of their state. Mm-hmm. So that's a really great place to look that a lot of people aren't aware of. And then once you're admitted in college, make sure you check with the actual academic department that you're admitted into, because they have a whole resource listing of scholarships specifically for students at their college studying whatever it is, you know, that you're studying. There's some great websites out there. There's so many that you can actually get overwhelmed, mm-hmm. but a couple of my favorites are scholarships.com. They have a really great search directory feature where you can search specifically based on certain criteria, such as, you know, your grade level or academics or what you're studying or abilities. And then myscholly.com, myscholly.com. They do charge like $7.99 a month, but it's really worth it. I've seen students have a lot of success on both of these sites.
Okay. Yeah, it would seem to me, too, that when you think about as a student, not that maybe you shouldn't have a high school job or something like that, but if you're thinking, oh, I'm probably going to get paid $10 or $11 an hour doing the high school job, and you factor it in and you think, I'm going to spend 40 hours, which $400 that I would make, and instead put that towards potentially getting
yes.
these scholarships, your hourly rate could balloon by going after scholarships instead of going and working the regular job.
It could really, yeah. I recommend an hour to an hour and a half a week. So if you think about it, like five hours a month searching and applying for scholarships, you could easily apply for 3 to 5 scholarships a month that way. And, you know, if you're consistent, I know it can be frustrating when you don't hear back, but it's just those students that apply for a handful of them, they're not applying for enough. You know, you just have to be in there doing it regularly.
Very nice.
And yeah, it's definitely worth doing that versus.
Yeah, okay.
Making.
Yeah, your minimum wage job or. And yeah. there are certainly skills to be gained when you are working outside of the home and you've got a direct boss as opposed to. I almost see scholarships as like this. It's like an on ramp to entrepreneurship where it's just like, I get to choose the jobs that I want. And sure, I guess it's also up to you as to what the chances are of you actually winning one of some of those scholarships. But there obviously is something additional to the dollars that you gain from working outside
of the
home.
It's like the more proactive of and go-getter you are, more you're going to crush your scholarships.
The possibility, the potential to totally kill it when it comes to scholarships.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I've seen a number of students do that, for sure.
So do you have any other sort of like outside-of-the-box recommendations to help folks to avoid that ever-increasing pile of student loans that our nation is burdened with, where folks out there can kind of try to attempt to bring down the cost of college?
Oh, yeah. So, it's so tough. Every college allows you to set up like a payment plan, which if you do owe a balance after financial aid, I always tell families, make a monthly payment plan over 10 months out of pocket, the maximum that you can afford to really kind of minimize that, debt. Also, students can begin applying for scholarships. They have scholarships for young students, but a lot of them start at the age of 13. So high school students, every single year they're in high school, can be applying for these scholarships. And then once they, they hit college, they can apply every year they're in college. Mm-hmm. So just, make that like a part, like I said, 5 hours a month.
Okay. All right, Tina, last question for you. You have a current high school senior, your last one. Is there anything you're doing that you haven't shared with us or in our audience yet that like we need to know about?
Anything that I'm doing with her?
Don't hold back. Give us the good stuff.
Oh, gosh. Well, I think we just have those really hard conversations in our house about what we're willing to spend and what the bottom line is. And if you want this particular college and we get this financial aid, like you've got to have some skin in the game, like be applying for those scholarships, my daughter is definitely doing that. Like I work with parents of high school seniors every single year in a group coaching program. And I preach this, but the reality is, high school seniors are so busy with everything else. I think in my house, that's really what we're doing. The outside scholarships and then the financial aid appeal is a big strategy.
Nice. I love it. It's so important to have those honest, straightforward conversations. And sounds like you've had some practice and
not just a one-off combo either, by the way.
Absolutely. That's so important as opposed to it being this thing that feels like you're tiptoeing around and all of a sudden, oh, surprise, no, this is going to be debt that you're going to be saddled with. This isn't something that we're willing to take on. These are conversations that have to start early. And I love hearing that there are 13-year-olds who are also eligible for scholarships as well. I think that's huge.
Yeah.
But Tina, thank you so much for talking with us. We'll make sure to link to the FAFSAguru.com. That's your website. Mm-hmm. You offer one-on-one help with families who are looking for maybe some additional help as well. Is that right?
I do. I do consulting. I also, my signature program is my Financial Aid Academy, a group coaching program I run every single year for parents of high school seniors. Enrollment is still open for seniors for the class of 2024 because the FAFSA is opening late, where I kind of guide families through the whole process and help them maximize their financial aid offers. And then I have a membership program for parents of high school students to kind of get them ready for college, and some standalone digital courses. And the consulting, and I offer a free 10-minute consult call for anybody that I've never worked with before.
Very cool.
That's great. Tina, thank you so much for joining us on the show today. We really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me, you guys.
All right. I feel like Tina knocked it out of the park when it came to answering all the FAFSA questions we had.
Yeah,
Joel, would
right?
you expect anything less?
No. Not if you call yourself the guru, I expect
guru. You better know your stuff.
That's right.
We covered a lot regarding the FAFSA. Did you have a specific takeaway, a big takeaway from today's episode?
Yeah, I did. And she didn't say it exactly like this, but it's something you and I have talked about a lot on the show in the past is don't be afraid to ask for a discount. And because like when you ask, truly, so much of the time, you're able to get one. But so many people just haven't exercised that muscle. They're kind of afraid to approach that conversation. They're worried about the stank eye that they're going to get from somebody if they do end up, if they make that request. Most of the time, you don't get the stink eye. Maybe every once in a while. Most of the time, either you're going to get told no, which who cares? Like, walk away, be like, all right, thank you anyway. Or other times, you might get quite a bit of money back. And in the case of appealing a student aid offer, it can be thousands and thousands or tens of thousands of dollars. And so it's one of those things where it's kind of like that Geico commercial, like 15 minutes will save you whatever percent. 15 minutes or 30 minutes of doing this appeal could save you thousands. And so it's you're silly you're really silly. You're leaving money on the table if you don't.
Absolutely. Yeah. And be humble.
When you
do make that request, which was so good, because again, having been on the receiving end of things, she has seen how this works. And I think it's a part of what makes Tina so effective at what she does, because she has been on the inside.
Yeah. And it's important to mention that there are humans reading them, right?
Yeah.
These are not just number crunching AI bots. These are human people with real emotions. And so if you can speak to that sense, like, hey, love the school, blah, blah, blah. And you know, this would mean so much to our family. And oh my goodness, whatever. I had the color, because the color matters to the end person who's actually doing the reading.
Yeah. Cause this is the difference between them letting you in and you've got an awesome story and you've made a just incredibly convincing argument as to why it is you want to go to that school, or somebody else who just says, please reconsider.
Yeah.
Like, who would you go with? And when you are working for a higher education institution like that, you want folks who are able to provide vibrance, and you're going to be looking to folks who are willing to lean in, to push back a little bit, because those are the folks who get stuff done.
And I don't want to oversimplify it, but it could be something like that, right? And they're like, we've got an extra $5,000. Which one do we give it to? And so, yeah, write your letter accordingly. Matt, what was your big takeaway from this combo, though?
So mine's going to be 5.65%, because that is the percentage of the parental assets that are taken into account when it comes to FAFSA determining student aid. Not specifically because that money is set aside within a 529 account, but, well, fact is, all of your assets are taken into account. And I think sometimes folks can have maybe this roadblock to setting some of that money aside, because they think, well, every dollar I stick in there is a dollar that I'm not going to receive via student aid, via financial aid. Well, that's not the case. That's not how it works. And so I just want to put that out there, because I think that can help to put a lot of folks at ease as to whether or not they see the amount that they've got saved in cash go in the bank go up by $10,000, or whether or not they, you know, a 529 account goes up. Whether that goes up by $10,000, either way, you're looking at 5.65%. And I think that number specifically can just provide a lot of relief for some folks out there. But let's introduce our beer. You and I, we enjoyed a Blue Crab Special Reserve. Sounds like a very fancy beer.
Yeah, it does.
This is another one by Other Half. It's a double dry hopped Imperial IPA. What were your thoughts, buddy?
All right. So my phrase to describe this one is creamy pineapple hop basket.
And ooh.
I feel like it's pretty accurate, right? What do you think? Pretty good?
I second all those descriptions.
Okay. All right. Well, yeah, no, just absolutely delicious IPA from one of the breweries that makes some of the finest in the land. So massively impressed with this one. And I guess they have a regular Blue Crab, but this is the Special Reserve. And so this is like the fancy version of the original beer, which I'm sure is already delightful. So
good.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's got those herbal elements from the hops, and you just get that with some of these dry hopped hazies. Of course, this isn't a beer by Other Half that includes a name of a vegetable, like they oftentimes do, but it's totally got those same vibes going on.
Yeah.
It is so fantastic. And again, a massive thanks to Jason for donating this, plus all the other half beers here to the podcast.
Appreciate you, Jason. Thank you very much. And Matt, that's going to do it for this one.
Yeah.
And we'll put links to some of the resources that we mentioned during this podcast up on our website at howtomoney.com.
That's right. FAFSAGuru.com, scholarships.com, MySchoolly. Those were Tina's two favorite sites for scholarships specifically.
Yeah.
Make sure to link to those.
All that stuff and more up there. You can also sign up for the How to Money newsletter at howtomoney.com/newsletter. If you haven't signed up for that yet, you should be ashamed of yourself.
You're missing out.
You should be ashamed, but you can write that ship right now, so please do. All right, Matt, that's going to do it for this episode. Until next time, best friends out.
Best friends out.
Upswell Marketing would like to remind you that when customers choose your small business, they're really choosing you. So focus on super serving your existing customers and let Upswell handle the pipeline generation of new leads and customers.
Upswell specializes in developing customized direct response campaigns and is now offering a no obligation free assessment of your current marketing strategies.
Not to mention, new customers also receive 15% off their first order when they mention that they heard about Upswell on this podcast. For more information, visit upswellmarketing.com. That's upswellmarketing.com. When it comes to your finances, go for the credit card that's always there for you. With 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night.
Yep, that means no more waiting for, quote, normal business hours just to get a hold of someone. We're talking real service from real people whenever you need it. Get the customer service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.